Merrin waited another few days for the rise of the full moon before he took once more to the south road. As Taita rode down the column, Merrin saw him looking at the water pots and lime bags strapped to the back of each pack mule. Hurriedly he explained, "I am certain we will have no further need of them, but—" He groped for an explanation. Taita supplied it. "They are too valuable to discard. We can sell them in Kibui." "Exactly what I had in mind," Merrin looked relieved. "Not for an instant did I doubt the efficacy of your magic. I am sure that from now on we will find only good water ahead." So it proved. The next pool they came to was green and filled with huge catfish that had long barbels round their mouths. The shrinking pools had concentrated them in dense shoals, so they were readily speared. Their flesh was bright orange and rich with fat. They made delicious eating. Among the men, Taita's reputation was now carved in marble and embossed in pure gold. The four captains and their troopers were ready to follow him to the ends of the earth, which was exactly what Pharaoh had ordered them to do. Fodder for the horses was always in short supply, but Taita had passed that way before and hunted in the surrounding country. He led them on detours from the river to hidden valleys in which grew stands of a low, leathery desert shrub that seemed dead and desiccated, but buried beneath each plant an enormous tuber was filled with water and nutrients. They were the staple diet of the oryx herds in hard times. They poured them up with their hooves. The troopers chopped them into chunks. At first the horses refused to touch them, but hunger soon overcame their reluctance. The men cached the water pots and lime bags and replaced them with tubers. They sustained the pace of the march over the ensuing months, but the weaker horses started to falter. When they broke down, the troopers dispatched them with a sword blow between the ears that went deep into the skull. They left their bones to bleach in the sun. In all, 22 died before they faced the final obstacle, the Shabluka Gorge, a narrow cutting through which the Nile forced its way. Above the gorge, the Nile in spate was almost a mile wide. However, through the gorge it was compressed to 100 yards from one steep rocky bank to the other. When they camped below it, they saw running water for the first time since they had left Karnak. A thin stream emerged through the rocky chute and spilled into the pool below. However, it had not run more than a mile before it was sucked into the sands and vanished below them. They ascended the Shabluka Ridge up a wild goat track along the lip of the gorge. From the summit they looked southwards across the plains to a distant line of low blue hills. "The Kareri Hills," said Taita. "They stand guard over the two Niles. Kibui is only some 50 leagues ahead." The course of the river was marked by groves of palm trees along each bank, and they followed the western bank towards the hills. The river flowed stronger as they drew nearer to Kibui, and their spirits rose. They covered the last leg of the journey in a single day, and at last stood at the confluence of the Nile. Kibui was the outpost at the furthest limit of the Egyptian domain. The small fort housed the governor of the nome and a detachment of border guards. The town spread out along the southern bank. It was a trading post, but even at this distance they could see that many buildings were run down and abandoned. All trade with Mother Egypt in the north had been strangled by the failure of the Nile. Few were prepared to take a caravan along the perilous road that Taita, Merrin, and their men had negotiated. "This flow of water comes down from the highlands of Ethiopia," Taita pointed to the wide eastern river course. The water was running, and they could see Shadoof wheels turning along the far bank as they lifted the water into the irrigation channels. Wild fields of green durra surrounded the town. "I expect to find good supplies of grain here to fatten the horses," Merrin smiled with pleasure. "Yes," Taita agreed. "We shall have to rest now until they are fully recovered." He patted Windsmoke's neck. She was sadly out of condition. Her ribs were showing and her coat was dull. Even though Taita had shared his rations of durra with her, feeding her foal and the rigours of the journey had taken their toll on her. Taita turned his attention to the eastern fork of the river. "That is the way Queen Lostris led the exodus," he said. "We sailed the galleys as far as the mouth of another steep gorge, which they could not surmount, anchored them there, and went on with chariots and wagons. In the mountains the Queen and I chose the site of Pharaoh Mamosa's tomb. I designed it and concealed it most cunningly. I have no doubt it has never been discovered and desecrated, nor will it be, For a short while, he reflected on his achievement with satisfaction, then went on. The Ethiopians have fine horses, but they are warriors and fiercely defend their mountain fastnesses. They have driven back two of our armies sent to subdue them and bring them into the empire. I fear that there will never be a third attempt. He turned and pointed directly down the southern branch of the river. It was wider than the eastern fork, but it was dry, not even a trickle moving in its bed. That is the direction we must follow. After a few short leagues, the river enters the swamp that has already swallowed two armies without trace. However, if we are fortunate, we will find it much reduced. Perhaps we might find an easier way through it than the others did. With judicious use of the royal hawk seal, we will be able to procure from the governor native guides to lead us. Come, let us cross to Kibui. The governor had been stranded at this outpost for the 7 years of the drought. His name was Nara, and he was bent and yellowed after constant attacks of swamp fever. But his garrison was in much better case. They were well fed with durra, and their horses were fat. Once Meron had showed him the royal seal and informed him of Taita's identity, Nara's hospitality was unbounded. He ushered Taita and Meron to the guest house in the fort and placed the best rooms at their disposal. He sent slaves to attend them and his own cooks to prepare their meals, then threw open his armory for them to re-equip their men. "Choose the horses you need from the remount depot. Tell my quartermaster how much durra and hay you require. There is no need to stint. We are well provisioned." When Meron inspected the men in their new quarters, he found them well content. "The rations are excellent. There are not many women in the town, but those few are friendly. The horses and mules are filling their bellies with durra and green grass. No one has any complaint," Hilto reported. After his long exile, Governor Nara was eager for news of the civilized world and hungry for the company of sophisticated men. In particular, Taita's learned dissertations fascinated him. Most evenings he invited him and Meron to dine with him. When Taita revealed to him their intention to ride south through the swamps, Nara looked grave. "Nobody returns from the lands beyond the swamps. I believe implicitly that they lead to the end of the earth, and those who go there are swept over the edge into the abyss." Then hastily he adopted a more optimistic tone. "These men bore the royal hawk seal, and he should encourage them in their duty. Of course there is no reason why you should not be the first to reach the end of the earth and return safely. Your men are tough, and you have the Magus with you." He bowed to Taita. "What more can I do to assist you? You know you have only to ask." "Do you have native scouts to guide us?" Taita asked. "Oh, yes," Nara assured him. "I have men who come from somewhere out there." "Do you know what tribe they belong to?" "No. But they are tall, very black, and tattooed with strange designs." "Then they are probably Shilluk," Taita said, pleased. During the exodus, General Lord Tanos recruited several regiments of the Shilluk. They are intelligent men and readily instructed. Although they are of cheerful disposition, they are fearsome fighters. "That would describe them well enough," Governor Nara agreed. "Whatever their tribe, they seem to know the country well. The two men I have in mind have worked with the army for some years and have learnt a little of the Egyptian language. I will send them to you in the morning." In the dawn, when Taita and Meron left their quarters, they found two Nubians squatting against the wall of the courtyard. When they rose to their feet, they towered even over Meron. Their lean frames were sheathed in flat, hard muscle, decorated with intricate patterns of ritual scarring, and their skin shone with oil or fat. They wore short skirts of animal skin and carried long spears with barbed heads carved from bone. "I see you, men," Taita greeted them in Shilluk. "Men" was a term of approbation, used only between warriors, and their handsome Nilotic faces lit with delight. "I see you, ancient and wise one," the taller man replied. Those also were terms of reverence and respect. Taita's silver beard had made a deep impression on them. "But how is it that you speak our tongue so well?" "Have you heard of lion liver?" Taita asked. The Shilluk considered the liver to be the seat of a man's courage. "How? How?" They were astonished. It was the name that their tribe had given Lord Tanus when they served under him. "Our grandfather spoke of lion liver, for we are cousins. He fought for that man in the cold mountains of the east. He told us that Lion Liver was the father of all warriors. Lion Liver was my brother and my friend, Taita told him. Then you are truly old, older even than our grandfather. They were even more impressed. Come, let us sit in the shade and converse, Taita led them to the enormous fig tree in the center of the courtyard. They squatted in the council circle facing each other, and Taita questioned them closely. The elder cousin was their spokesman. His name was Nakontu, the Shilluk word for the short stabbing spear. For in battle I have slain many. He was not boasting, but stating a fact. My cousin is Nontu, for he is short. All things are relative, Taita smiled to himself. Nontu stood a full head taller than Merin. Where do you come from, Nakontu? From beyond the swamps, he indicated the south with his chin. Then you know the southern lands well. They are our home. For a moment he seemed wistful and nostalgic. Will you lead me to your home? I dream every night of standing by the graves of my father and grandfather, Nakontu said softly. Their spirits are calling you, said Taita. You understand, old one. Nakontu looked at him with deepening respect. When you leave Kibui, Nontu and I will go with you to show you the way. Two more full moons had shone down upon the pools of the Nile before the horses and their riders were fit to travel. On the night before their departure, Taita dreamed of fishes in vast shoals of every colour, shape, and size. You will find me hiding among the other fishes, Fen's sweet, childish voice echoed through the dream. I will be waiting for you. He woke in the dawn with feelings of happiness and soaring expectations.